From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. It's a beautiful Saturday morning here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, coming to you from the studios of Ave Maria Radio, 990 WDEO AM. And it's really a great honor to talk to you today about our program. We're going to have a wonderful guest on, Lucia Vitti. Her book is entitled Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey. Her father was a combat surgeon in Vietnam in 1967, a Marine. We're going to hear a lot about Marines today out there, all the hoo-ahs and all those other things that go on with Marines. And I'm really excited to have her and her guests along with her on the program. We're going to talk to them just a little bit after we take a break. But joining us on the line right now, calling from the Ann Arbor VA. Whoops, sorry.
Hey,
Derek. Sorry, Derek.
Yes.
Our studio is aligned with the phone is on the other side of the room, it seems like. But anyway, Derek Atkinson, Public Affairs Officer from the Ann Arbor VA. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Dale. How are you doing today?
We're doing terrific, and I understand you've got a big event coming up in February. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We're really excited, Dale. We are doing our first ever Valentine's for Veterans concert. So just kind of give some background on this. The week of February 10th through February 16th, every year all across the country, is something called National Salute to Veteran Patients Week. So what this means is this is an opportunity for the VA to invite the local community members, local government leaders, celebrities into our VAs to visit the patients that we have in our medical center. So last year we had the Governor Snyder come through. We had Congressman Dingell, Congressman Wahlberg. Miss Michigan came through. Pretty much the entire Eastern Michigan football team came through with Coach Mike Hart, who used to play over at the U of M. So that is this big week. It's a big outreach week for VA, and we're really excited to have a lot of events lined up this year for that.
So around the country, all the different VAs around the country should have some sort of events going on this week, that week.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So pretty much every medical center in the country will have guests coming in. You know, down in Chicago, Gary Sinise is a big veteran supporter, as you probably know, mm-hmm. With the Lieutenant Dan Band. He goes into the Chicago VA quite a bit, and there's actually a national chairperson who heads this up, and that is Charlie Murphy, who is the brother of comedian Eddie Murphy. Charlie is a comedian and an actor, and he's a Navy veteran, so he's kind of the national chairman this week for this whole National Salute to Veteran Patients Week.
Okay. Well, so what are we going to be doing in Ann Arbor?
Yeah, so we're excited to kick this off on Sunday, February 10th, with our first ever Valentine's for Veterans concert. So part of this whole week, the National Salute Week, is throughout the country there were 16 locations selected to do a Valentine's for Veterans concert, and we just happened to be one of them, and we are really excited about that. We're having country artist Aaron Tippin come in, and he's going to do a concert for us. It's absolutely complimentary. Right now, tickets are flying out the door. We have a phone line set up that you can call and get tickets, and essentially if you come into the VA and go to our voluntary service department, we're just giving the tickets away to interested parties. But it will be an awesome time, and Aaron Tippin he's a huge veteran supporter. Aaron spends a lot of time doing veteran concerts. He's common on the USO tours, goes overseas, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and other places, and just puts on shows for the troops. So we're really excited, and he has a really special show lined up for us. So that is February 10th, 2013, at Pease Auditorium at Eastern Michigan University at 2 p.m. And I can give a number out here. We have a phone line set up at 734-222-7994. And essentially, I'll just give folks a little more information about the concert, and then pretty much direct them to come into the VA and go to our voluntary service department and pick up their tickets.
Okay, so I understand that this is a free concert to everybody
yes.
in the community, not just veterans. It's for everyone, all of those veteran supporters out there. We would love to have you come on out and support this concert. I think it sounds like a great opportunity, and I'm going to take my opportunity on the air right now to ask you to please reserve two tickets for me. I know you've already talked with Nina. Hey, and also, if you come down to the concert, you might meet some of the Veterans Radio crew over there, and you can see that we look just as good as our voices sound. But anyway, okay, so it's Sunday, February 10th at 2 p.m. at Pease Auditorium over on the Eastern Michigan University campus. And for more information, they can contact the VA here in Ann Arbor at 734-222-7994, correct?
Yes, that is correct, Dale. And thank you so much for letting us come on and talk about this. And I'll just add in another thing. So we open up tickets only for veterans on the 7th. So this is the last weekend for veterans. This is the only weekend, the last weekend, that will be open just for veterans. So on Tuesday, after the holiday, tickets will be available to everybody, the community, our staff.
Veterans only until Tuesday.
Then it opens up to the public on Tuesday. So once it opens to the public, we kind of expect it to go pretty quick. But you know, we've already given away probably about 600 to 750 tickets already. So they've been going really fast. So if anybody's interested, I would just really encourage them to give us a call and get down there and to the VA and get your tickets.
Well, we will do everything that we can. In fact, we'll try to remind everybody next weekend, and maybe we can find a cut of one of Aaron Tippin's songs so they can hear what they're going to go and see.
It's great. And, you know, I'll kind of give a little secret here, but during the show, he's famous for building a bicycle. It's kind of different. He gets up there on stage, he sings a few songs, and then he kind of takes a little prologue, and he puts together a bicycle, and at the end of the show, he gives it away to local Marines for Toys for Tots. So it's really something cool.
All right, and everybody out there, get yourselves on the phone. Give them a call on Tuesday if you're not a veteran. If you are a veteran, call today. Get those tickets. I'll give that number one more time, 734-222-7994. And this is for Salute to Veterans Week. This is Valentine's for Veterans. How nice. I'm looking forward to it, Derek. Thank you very much for calling into Veterans Radio, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Hey, thanks so much, Dale. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you again. All right, folks, there's your opportunity on the local level. On the national level, check out your local VA. They may be I'm sure that they are having some sort of events during that entire week. I know that they did that here. I was talking with Bob this morning as a partner here on Veterans Radio, and he mentioned that the VA down in Detroit is also having a program during the Salute to Veterans Week. So check around locally. In the meantime, get ready here, folks, because we're going to take a break, and then we're going to be coming back and talking with Lucia Vitti, and her book is entitled Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
All right. Well- Welcome back to Veterans Radio. As you can probably tell, we're going to be talking about Marines today, and Marines are a totally different breed. As I was sitting here thinking about that, you know, I was in the Army. And we were pretty close, I thought. But after reading Lucia's book, it's just amazing how the camaraderie, the loyalty, and the devotion to each other is there in the Marine Corps. And so I'm really pleased and excited to welcome Lucia Vitti to Veterans Radio today. Lucia, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yes, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's exciting. I finished your book last night, and I have to tell you, as I mentioned earlier in the week to you, that it was a fun read, but it was also very disturbing in a lot of different ways. I was very fortunate during my tour in Vietnam not to see everything that these Marines saw, seemed like on a daily activity or a daily basis. And we're going to talk about this. We've got some other people that will be joining us from the book that you interviewed. But let me get into this right away, and I'll let you start doing the talking. Your book is entitled Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey. Tell me about Dr. Vitti.
Oh, Dr. Tom, he was one of the kindest, most gregarious men anyone would ever want to meet. He was not only a doctor, he was a caretaker, he was a psychologist, he was a psychiatrist, and he all did it with a great, great sense of humor. He was very much faith-based, an Italian Catholic. His father was a doctor. He comes from a long line of people involved in medicine, and he really loved medicine for the sheer sake of medicine, for the sheer sake of helping people. He was a magnanimous man. He was well-loved by everyone. He was infamous for always being able to add a sense of humor to a situation that was grave, yet with a smile and yet with his faith.
You can tell that right away from the book. What caused you to write this? Give us a little background of that secret find that you found.
That secret find couldn't have been, you know, sometimes, as they say, truth is stranger than fiction. It was actually after 9/11. My parents, both of them, had passed away in 1987. And we had, my brothers and I, had never just placed all the pictures from our years as a family in a box. And after 9/11, I decided it was time to take those pictures and disseminate them accordingly. And I was in my brother's attic, and we were gathering all these boxes. And I tripped over this rather huge Harry and David box. In the olden days, as they say, the boxes were a lot bigger than they are today. And I just assumed that they were more family photographs. And when I opened it, it literally was a box of my father's Vietnam memorabilia. Now, I was young enough to understand and remember that he had gone to Vietnam, but I certainly wasn't old enough to understand the capacity to which he served. And as I went through it, literally the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I knew that this was a man I had never known. I was, you know, 26 when he had passed, so now here, many years later, I really wanted to understand this doctor of the war. So I'm originally from New York, but I live in San Diego now, and I took the box back with me, and I sat down and I looked through it, and it was completely out of my norm of scope, so to speak. I am a writer. I have a degree in journalism, but my writing has been in the field of health and wellness for many years. So to step into the Vietnam War was a big step for me. But once I decided to do it, I gathered up men like Colonel Esau, who was my father's very, very good friend for many, many, many years, and knew my mother serendipitously as they were growing up. And once I decided to embrace the journey, it became just that, a journey. The night that I posted who I was and my interest in speaking with people who knew my father on the 2nd Battalion, 5th Marine website, I had so many responses that they blew out my inbox. So from top to bottom, I was a little nervous about writing about the Vietnam War, so I spent about 4 years between research and movies and documentaries and sit-rep reports and just every kind of piece of paper I could get, whether it was on the Marines or the Army or Ho Chi Minh, anything and everything about communism and socialism. And one day when I sat down, I was just inundated with all of this material, and I realized that I didn't have to rewrite history, that there were many books out there who would that have already explained the genesis of the Vietnam War and its 11-year journey, that I needed to really write the words of the men that I spoke to. I traveled for more than almost about 2 years across the country, meeting with men who knew him, and sometimes that was difficult because unless you were really at the combat base in An Hoa, you didn't get to know my father. Most of the meetings that he had, generally speaking, with men were injured or seriously injured, so they either had a very brief meeting with him as they were getting on a helicopter, or they were, you know, not conscious, basically, you know, to put it very blunt. Mm-hmm. But the men at the combat base who were able to develop relationships with him, or the men that were hurt and not hurt badly enough to be shipped out of the combat base, these were the men who knew my dad, and these were the men who just shared stories that were so very, very rich. But in my endeavor to find out about my dad, I also realized that the book couldn't just be about my dad, because a lot of the stories that I heard from the men, not only my father served as the conduit, so not only were they able to speak about my dad, but they were able to share stories with me as they had never shared with anyone in 40 plus years. You have to remember, when, as you know, when you came back from the Vietnam War, you know, some of these men said that they changed in the bathroom. They didn't want anybody to know that they were of the military scope. So part of the book is really dedicated to my father, and the other part of the book is dedicated to these really brave men who were willing to speak. And I applaud, I so applaud their journey, because I truly believe that America learned from this experience never to shun the warrior the way they did with these Vietnam veterans.
I'm sitting here thinking of some of the lines that were in the book, and later on there's a quote that I want to read in there. It talks about at a VFW hall, I believe it was, where some members of World War II Greatest Generation said that, you know, we're kind of a pretty good generation too, and I'm excited to do that. But I'm just fascinated by the way that you were able to contact all these people and travel back and forth across the country. Now, your father is from New York. It's sometimes when I talk to you, I can hear the accent in your voice. It's I miss it a lot. but being from New Jersey, you know, you kind of miss some of those things. But he went. Where did he go to medical school, and how did he end up in the Marines anyhow?
Well, you know, it's funny. My father was the oldest, and he was the oldest only male out of five girls, and in a traditional Catholic Italian household in Brooklyn. And he was the apple of my grandmother and his great grandmother's eye. So my grandfather, who was a very bright man, a little bit regimented, as they described him, and I remember him very much the doctor. He was the neighborhood physician. Decided that he thought little Tommy would get softened by all of this female attention. So he shipped him to LaSalle Military Academy for high school.
No.
So I think my father was always within his heart of the military scope. And he went to Georgetown, as I described in his book, but my grandfather said he was more popular with the women than he was with his grades, so they shipped him to an all-Catholic male school in Vermont, St. Michael's College. Oh, and he was always interested in medicine. He would, as you know, they used to go up to Haines Falls, where my aunt still has a home, and they said that he used to catch frogs and dissect them. So I think medicine was always his first love, and I don't know if that was passed down from my grandfather, I'm sure. And he met my mom in Haines Falls, and he worked in Sloan Kettering and tried to get into med school here, but his grades weren't good enough. So they shipped him to Europe, and he went to school in Padova, in the medical school about 20 minutes south of Venice. And he came back here as a physician, and he was drafted. And he could have deferred his deployment, but I think LaSalle Military Academy had really been embedded in his heart, and so he decided that if he was going to go, that he was going to go on his terms. So he went and he signed up for the Fleet Marine Force, and And as you know, mm-hmm. he really he's a naval officer. The naval officers take care of all the medics. So he assigned himself for a Fleet Marine Force. And the story is that my mother knew what he had done because he came home with a tight and high haircut.
Uh-oh.
Yep.
A definite giveaway.
It was a definite giveaway, and that was in October of 1966. So he had gotten the letter, which I have here in June. The story also goes is that he hid it from her. Mm-hmm. So she didn't know anything until he came home with the haircut, and that was in October. And November, he was in Camp Pendleton, and by January, he was in Anwar, 25 miles southwest of Da Nang.
Wow. It's amazing, and we should explain to our audience. I'm talking with Lucia Avidi, whose book is Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey, about her father, who was a medical combat physician in Vietnam. Is that the naval doctors and the naval corpsmen worked with the Marines? Is that the way that it worked? The Marines didn't have their own separate medical doctors and so forth, right?
Yes, sir. That's how it works. All corpsmen are naval. All battalion surgeons are naval. Basically, all medical medical personnel are of naval origin.
Okay, I thought so, but I wasn't positive. I had many of the stories in here were great to read, folks. You got to get this book. It's a fascinating read. It's very colorful. Let's put it that way too. Language-wise.
Yes.
Too. But the language is the true language of what these people used when they were in country. And I know that my vocabulary had to clean up quite a bit when I got home. And somebody told me the other day at the end of World War II, all the veterans coming back from World War II said number one on their list is that they had to clean up their language.
And, right.
Well, you want to be expedient, you know. You don't want to flower things up, and so. But there's some of that in there. But there are great stories, and we've got two people on the line, Lucia, that I want to bring on and introduce to the audience, and then we'll kind of go from their stories. The first is, Colonel Richard Esau. Just a second here.
Sure.
Hate the silence. So, Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
It certainly is a pleasure to have you on the program and to read your story in Lucia's book, and I'm anxious to get back to you. And on my other line is John Newton, who, as far as I know, was a lieutenant in the Marines. I know you're always Marines. You're never not Marines. But, John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Were you a career also, or did you get out?
No, I was just a four-year guy.
Okay, but you're still a Marine, I know that.
Well, according to the most recent commandant, yeah, he reinstated us all as we are now all Marines again.
Oh, all right, great. Well, Colonel Esau, you're one of the first chapters in the book, and Lucia, how did you arrange this conversation?
Again, as truth is often stranger than fiction, that was not arranged. That actually happened. As you know, I mean, Colonel Lisa, I'm probably the sixth child, seventh child. We've all grown up together, and when I decided to write this book, he was the first person that I approached and first place that I went to, although I have a guest room there that I go every year, sometimes twice, to visit. And I had been reading and reading and reading, and I had all of these impressive documents in front of me, and we were literally sitting there watching the baseball game, and I was trying to get him to talk a little bit more, and his answers were very evasive. And it really was because of the book that I was reading. And I just decided that it was just such a colorful evening as far as the dialogue between the guests that we had, Ken Noonan and Naomi and myself. I just asked if I could keep the tape recorder on during dinner. And then I did, and I realized that that would be the first chapter, because that was basically, in essence, what I did throughout the story, is that I just asked them a question or two. And there were times that I would ask a question if I was interviewing a Marine over the phone, and literally two Marines blew out the battery on my phone. I didn't need to ask another question after that. I just let them speak. I was the perfect listener for everything that they had within them. So, of course, the colonel would be my first place and my most informative place, and I think he was, throughout the years, the closest individual in the book to my father. Say, Colonel.
Colonel?
Yeah, well, you did. Your dad was the bravest man that I ever met in my life, and no, he lived the Hippocratic Oath. It wasn't that he was just taking care of all of us that were at ANWR, you know, the military people. He was taking care of all the civilians as well. And the Viet Cong, you know, put a price on his head initially because he was making them look bad. He was looking after everybody's children and so forth. And after a while, they realized that the American Bok Si, which is doctor, was actually doing good things. And so they took the price off his head, and Tom Beattie was one of the few people who could move around in our tactical area of responsibility, which was huge. You know, it was 144 square miles and went all the way to the Laotian border. And but he could move around and look after people without the fear that the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese were going to blow him away. I had him with me on numerous operations, and in many cases, I really didn't want him in the field because he was the battalion surgeon. I could afford to lose a corpsman, but I couldn't afford to lose my battalion surgeon. But in the middle of a firefight, and we had more than a few of them, and I guess John Newton can talk to a couple of those, all of a sudden Tom Beattie would show up. And, you know, in the middle of this firefight, I'd have this little cherub, Tom Beattie, and I'd show up beside me and say, "What's up?" And I would say, "Tom, you know what's up. We're in the middle of a firefight, and you don't belong here. You belong back in the battalion aid station. I can't afford to let you get wounded." Well, the good Lord really looked after Tom Beattie. But an awful lot of people got wounded, but Tom Beattie, for some reason or other, could walk through a hail of bullets and shrapnel and so forth and come out on the other end unscathed and be out in the middle of a field somewhere working on a Marine who would have died otherwise because of his talent as a surgeon. He was an amazing, amazing human being, and I loved him dearly. He was a very religious man, by the way. You know, he and I and a good number of the people in the battalion had Catholic education. In my case, it was 16 years of Catholic education. And we certainly believed in God, and we also knew that there were no atheists in foxholes, that's for sure.
we know that. Colonel, could you describe Dr. Tom's physical size and things like that? The way you describe him, he's not a big man.
No, he wasn't huge at all, but the thing was, and in peacetime, you know, he had a tendency to get a little heavy, but in Vietnam, none of us really had a chance to get heavy.
Right.
So he was, I would say, about 5'8" tall, I think, and he didn't weigh that much in Vietnam, but he was the little engine that could. He was unbelievable, you know, how he could move around and direct his corpsman. And, of course, the corpsman very much wanted to live up to his expectations. So our corpsman, for heaven's sakes, I think in 1 6-month period, 15 of our corpsmen received the Silver Star for, bravery in combat. It is the third highest award. I think our corpsman had more of those kinds of awards than anybody. And in my heart of hearts, I know it was because they wanted to take care of the good doctor, who really took care of me, that's for sure.
Well, we got about a minute to go, and I want to bring on John here for a second. John, you also served with Dr. Tom. Can you tell me a little
Yes, I did.
Tell me a little about your perception of him.
Well, I had, three vivid tableaus that involved Dr. Tom. One was during a very heavy firefight in an operation called Newcastle. And one of my colleagues, a lieutenant that was leading another platoon, had been very badly wounded. And the doctor, as the then major, now colonel, said, was in the field where probably he shouldn't have been. He came trundling up in an Amtrak, and we helped our wounded colleague into the Amtrak, and he kind of collapsed on a bag of sandbags toward the back of it. And Dr. Tom immediately started cutting him open to save his life. And the ramp on the Amtrak was down, and it was a hot area, and there were rounds bouncing off the Amtrak, and they'd go into the Amtrak and rattle around through the Amtrak and ricochet back out. And he very steadily is performing his operation and at the same time shouting at the top of his lungs, "Close the door, close the door." And that's an image of him that has remained with me for almost 45 years now.
It's amazing what these people do. We're going to take a quick break. I hate to stop this story, but we'll be right back here on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Lucia Vitti, and her book is Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Lance Corporal Roy Wheat threw himself on an anti-personnel mine to save his fellow Marines. Details after this.
Have your boots on, you're wet, you're cold. You feel like it's the land of time for God. Drill instructors all over the place, they're like lying. And you ask yourself, my God, what did I get myself into? Your body's screaming, but your mind and your heart tells you, keep on going. Don't give up. You question yourself, do I have what it takes to become a United States Marine? In the back of my mind, I knew I was not going to quit on myself. And when you stand there on the parade deck, and that drill instructor comes in front of you, the one that made you better, holds out his hand, shakes your hand, and they call you brother, call you Marine, you break down in tears.
Private Ramon Hernandez became a United States Marine. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
Wheat and two other Marines were assigned the mission of providing security for a Navy construction battalion crane and crew operating along Liberty Road in the Quang province. After the Marines had set up security positions in a tree line adjacent to the work site, Wheat reconnoitered the area to the rear of their location for the possible presence of guerrillas. He then returned to within 10 feet of the friendly position and here, unintentionally, triggered a well-concealed bounding-type anti-personnel mine. Immediately, a hissing sound was heard, which was identified by the three Marines as that of a burning time fuse. Shouting a warning to his comrades, Wheat, in a valiant act of heroism, hurled himself upon the mine, absorbing the tremendous impact of the explosion with his body. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with a little 60s music. I always like to throw those into the program, just in case. Lucia, I was talking to Lucia Vitti, the author of Dr. Tom's War, and then I can't remember the name of the character in the book that had the little portable record player. And I was going to play the song that was constantly, I think it was a Beach Boys song or something, that everybody just went crazy over because he only had two records.
Right. Actually, that was Steve Zack. And it was a Johnny Cash song, I think, and something about losing a love. But, yeah, John Newton will be able to tell you more about that. I was pretty shocked when I heard it, but they carried battery-operated record players into the field sometimes. Say, John.
Well, one of the gunnery sergeant's biggest jobs in a Marine company was to make sure that when we went out to the field, all that stuff was left behind. And in some of the very colorful language, he would explain to the young Marines what he would do to them if he found them out in the field with things like radios and record players. And in spite of his encouragement, they always managed to kind of find their way out there. And it was not unusual to hear rock and roll drifting out through a fighting hole every now and then.
Can you only imagine with the technology of today what you would have to go through to get these guys not to listen to their music?
I agree.
I can't imagine that. John, you used to go out into these villages with Dr. Tom for these, what do you used to call them?
County fairs.
Yeah, county fairs. Can you talk about that a little bit for our audience so they know what they are?
Yeah, county fair was would
kick off at about the same time that this radio show does on the West Coast.
Sorry, 6 o'clock.
Marine, you need to have a chat.
Yeah, right. A marine company would usually just kind of drop down on a village and completely cordon it off so no one could come in and no one could go out. And then the medical staff would come in, and as well as the intelligence group, and they would screen people from an intelligence point of view, looking for identification cards and make sure that there were no infiltrators. And at the same time, the medical corps would be checking everyone in the village's teeth, giving them all a quick physical, giving them shots. They set up a sheet that ran Donald Duck cartoons in Vietnamese that could be seen from both sides of the sheet that focused on hygiene and how to take care of yourself. We'd spend the day there in the village and then just as quickly depart. And those were going on throughout the area of responsibility quite frequently.
I think that's really interesting for our audience to know that that the Marines especially were not there just to get the bad guys. You were also there to help out the citizenry with health issues and farming techniques and so on and so forth. And, I mean, the Vietnamese people have been fighting wars for thousands of years, it seemed like. And this sounds a little ethnocentric, but, you know, they were still hundreds and hundreds of years behind the rest of the world as far as sanitation and health is concerned. Is that true?
No, absolutely. If they had an open wound, for instance, the Band-Aid they used would be water buffalo dung to help it scab over. And it was like walking back in several centuries when you walked into one of their villages. But the part of the overall mission was, you know, win a heart and a mind. It was not necessarily all aggression. So in addition to county fairs, Marine units would have civil action patrols that would be a small squad of Marines that would live in the villages and work with them in terms of hygiene and developing what assets they had to make their lives more livable.
I think that's really important for our audience to understand. Colonel, I want to come back to you for a second. Dr. Tom and actually the Marine medics over there, they would fix up anybody that was injured, wouldn't they? It didn't make any difference if they were on our side or not.
No, that's true. And on more than one occasion, we had two or three or four Viet Cong or North Vietnamese soldiers in our battalion aid station, and Tom was taking care of them to make sure that he could stabilize them before, you know, we sent them back to Da Nang. I would like to make one point here. You know, in 1 2-week period, we had two of our Marines, Jim Graham, the company commander of Foxtrot 2-5, and Melvin Newland, who was a machine gunner with Foxtrot Company, they received the Medal of Honor. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is we were in an area that was very active, and the only way that you could stay ahead of the bad guys was to have very active patrolling. So our people were on the move all the time to make sure that we could hold down the 2nd NVA Division guys and the local main force VC so that they wouldn't be hitting our combat base. So it was an interesting time in my life, and in the middle of all of it is here's Tom Veedy, who for some reason or other the good Lord protected and he looked after people who would have died otherwise, by ministering to them in the middle of a firefight. So I can't say enough wonderful things about Tom Veedy. It is interesting to me that, you know, his father worked with my father at Madison Square Garden in New York, and I went to school with his wife for 8 years at St. Benedict's School, and I never met Tom Veedy until
did I just lose him? Sounds like we might have. I might have just lost the colonel. All right, we're gonna call Colonel Esau.
Okay. Well, I think what I can fill in the story.
Okay.
Colonel Esau and my mother grew up in the same neighborhood in the Bronx, and
okay.
They went to the same grammar school. And my father's, my grandfather, Dr. Vitti, worked in Madison Square Garden. He was the house doctor. And Colonel Esau's father was the head of security in Madison Square Garden. So my father had been in Anwar prior to Colonel Esau arriving. And in the course of the conversation with my mom, when he said, oh, we're having this, you know, new major come in, and it was Richard Esau, my mother said, you know, I went to school with him. And by that time, he already had known that there was a man who was head of security at Madison Square Garden. So my father literally played a little game with him when he first met. Because my mother, as the young Italian, as most young Italians are, who love their pasta and their bread, was chubby. Mm-hmm. And she had gotten thin. So he showed her a picture of my mother in grammar school as chubby. And then he showed a picture of my mother thin and said, that's Louise Vitti. You know, that's Louise Salido. And he said, no, that's Louise Vitti. And so they were bonded then. And literally, Colonel Esau has been like a second father to me since his passing. But, you know, that is one of the things that I discovered about my father that Colonel Esau was speaking of, is that he was really brave, almost recklessly brave. I don't think that there was any afterthought of what he was going to do when his first thought was administering to the wounded. That's how he received the Bronze Star with the Combat V, for administering to the wounded under firefighter as the combat base was being mortared on July 4th. And simultaneously, there was a coal mine that was being mortared, Nong Song. So the Vietnamese had coordinated a dual attack, and the COC, as John could say, was working not only with the coordinates for the combat base, but Nong Song. And my father left the COC and just began administering to the wounded within the combat base.
We've got Colonel Esau back on the line, I believe. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we found you. Good. We wandered outside the wire there for a minute. I just wanted, for our audience sake, Colonel, this was 1967, and the Marines were responsible mainly for I Corps, weren't they?
I Corps was pretty much ours, yeah.
Okay, I'm trying to get
all the way from the DMZ to south of us, yeah.
Okay, and your main opponent was a full-blown North Vietnamese Army brigade or division.
Yeah, the 2nd NVA division, you know, was working in our area coming out of Laos. And as John can tell you, you know, they would drop off the gear that the North Vietnamese needed up at Haiphong, and we would watch them carry it over to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then they would come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, and when they got just the other side of where we were, they would then try to infiltrate into our area so they could mortar and rocket the airfield at Da Nang. So it was a crazy war. Yeah, you know, if we had taken out the ships that brought the equipment in at Haiphong, we wouldn't have had to worry about what was going on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. But the political side said, no, we can't take out the Haiphong, we can't take out the Red River dikes, we can't even go into North Vietnam. How do you defeat an enemy by staying in South Vietnam when everything that he's using to combat you is coming out of North Vietnam? It was a crazy war.
It was a crazy war, and I want to talk a little bit about that after our next break, which is in about a minute and a half. And we'll talk about the Fourth Estate and some of the other things that many Vietnam veterans had to face when they came home. John, you were out in the field with Dr. Tom quite a bit, it sounds like. And as you mentioned, he would just kind of show up. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the corpsmen that you worked with, or maybe pick out one that you could tell our audience how these men worked?
Oh, man.
I know, choosing them is difficult. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to blindside you on that one.
Probably the most valuable asset in a rifle platoon is your corpsman. And they all have the same name. It's always Doc.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that particularly stands out was a young man that arrived there probably about a month after I did the end of January, first part of February. He was from Troy, New York, and it was his goal to at some point become a doctor. And the thing that I found interesting about him, he was wounded three times in about 5 weeks. And the rule was you get wounded three times, you go home, which is what he did. But in the 5 weeks that we were together, we got fairly close, as you might expect. And every time he got wounded, he became a little less a healer and a little more a warrior. And it was interesting to me, particularly in reflection, to see how he transitioned in his attitude toward, you know, life in general, I guess, through the experience that he was going through. And I've often wondered whether he was able to finally realize his dream. But like all of them, he was fearless. I mean, you'd call Doc, and regardless of what was going on in the battlefield, he was there to bring you back, and he knew that the Marines were there to keep him safe. And I think that that contributed largely to the feeling that they could go anywhere without any fear of harm. Just a great bunch of young men. And again, you need to realize that these kids were 18, 19 years old. An amazing performance from young people.
Well, I can certainly understand that. We have a doc here locally in our Vietnam Veterans of America who received a Silver Star for what he did over there. And, you know, very humble, but he always talked, I mean, he just loves the Marines, and that's just the way it is. We got to take another break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Lucia Vitti and a couple of other Marines about the book Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and again, a little bit of our favorite music right there. We're talking with Lucia Vitti, the author of Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey. Lucia, you talked to many, many Marines while you were researching the book, and it's just amazing the respect that they had and love that they had for your dad.
Yes, that was without saying. And there were two common denominators, his sense of humor and his bravery.
We can't really go into some of the practical jokes that he pulled. We did, you know, at least you'd have to get the book. There we go.
Right.
You have to read this book. For all you Marines and all you civilians out there that want to know what happened, especially during 1967, this is not only just about Dr. Tom. You've got a whole segment of the book that's devoted to just Marine anecdotal stories.
Right, and the most important part about that, the narrative of Dr. Tom's War, Daughter's Journey, is that it really is their own words.
Mm-hmm.
Stories that some of them shared with me and they had never shared with their wives and their mothers and brothers and sisters. So these were almost secrets that were told after 40 years when it was okay to tell them.
It is something, and talking with Colonel Esau and John Newton, you know, we all kind of kept a lot of these stories to ourselves because our relatives, they might have listened once and then they were done. They didn't need to hear them anymore. And, of course, civilians would never have understood in the first place, so we didn't talk about these things. Is that the way that you felt, John?
Well, I must admit that part of my wounding was
And I, like Dr. Tom, I managed to get through it all unscathed. But I did come back with this kind of Rime of the Ancient Mariner complex where, you know, every wedding party you see, you have to tell the story. So for a number of years, I gathered up my stuff, and I had a little slideshow that I put together, and I traveled around through high schools talking to high school kids at every opportunity. What veterans don't share so much is the specifics of what they did or had to do during a combat situation. They will tend to talk about it generally to most of the public, but once you get into the nitty-gritty, they will only share that with themselves.
That's very true. My partner, former partner Gary Lilly, would try to interview, you know, me and some other people, and you know, we'd give him the surface area of everything, and he says, no, I want to know what you really did. No, what did you do when that, you know, after that, whatever hair-raising experience it was? And it's true that it takes us a lot of time sometimes to come down and to rationalize some of the things that we saw, especially in the friends that we lost. That, you know, anyway, I'll get off that tangent here. Colonel, I wanted to come back to you to talk a little bit about the Marines, and in your segment, you talk about the Fourth Estate. And to those of us, you know, we understand that the Fourth Estate is usually media in one way or another. And this is not a pity party or a, you know, Vietnam veteran whining. I just wanted to know how you felt when you came home, or even while you were in country, about the coverage that the Vietnam War got. That's a long roundabout.
Well, I think the Fourth Estate, in general, after a while, they believed that we didn't belong in Vietnam. And as a result, their reporting was skewed. But having said that, I will tell you a story I don't think I've ever told anybody. I had a wounded Marine in the middle of a firefight, and of course I had a member of the Fourth Estate was with me at the time. And the member of the Fourth Estate was a woman. And she, I can't remember her name now, but she came from Reuters, I believe. And this kid was, we were going to lose him. He was dying. And he wanted to talk to his mother. And this woman took her helmet off, and she had, you know, long chestnut hair. And for all intents and purposes, she was his mother for the last few moments that he was on this earth. So having said nasty things about the Fourth Estate in this particular case, I was beholden to this woman for looking after my Marine. The whole thing is kind of crazy. I know John mentioned one of his corpsmen, but Tom was very lucky in that he had a chief hospital corpsman, Lou Legarry. Mm-hmm. Lou Legarry started his career with the Marines on Okinawa when he was a very, very young man. And he was with Chesty Puller at the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, where he received the Silver Star. And he was the chief hospital corpsman of 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines in Vietnam. And I think the other corpsman kind of idolized him. He was the kind of man you wanted to have around because he was a guy that knew what was going to happen before it happened. And right now I think he's about 85 years old, and he lives out there on the West Coast, and he is really a good friend of mine. But it's people like him and Dr. Vitti and the John Newtons of the world who, you know, went out there and did what their country asked them to do and then got spit on when we came home. So I have mixed feelings, I guess, about the Fourth Estate and the things that they did or didn't do.
Well, you mentioned in your comments, and John also, I think you mentioned it also, is that the politicians wouldn't let us fight this war. And my quick anecdotal thing is that, you know, you had to get permission to return fire sometimes. And, of course, it would take, you know, an hour or something along those lines. And you mentioned Ho Chi Minh Trail, and where I was, it came down through Cambodia, and you could see the trucks and everything, and we weren't allowed to intervene at all. And that was extremely frustrating.
Yeah, it was. For us, we had a free fire zone, as I told you. You know, our tactical area of responsibility was 144 square miles. That's 12 by 12 miles. And so we had a free fire zone. I didn't have to worry about, you know, getting permission to use our artillery. And we had plenty of artillery, and the artillerymen were very, very professional and could put an 8-inch round, for instance, in your back pocket if you asked them to. So it was a crazy, crazy war. I've often said that it was a one-year war. We fought 11 times.
Yes.
You know, and the reason for that was they didn't let us go into North Vietnam. Vietnam. How do you defeat an enemy if you can't go and take out, you know, the area that he comes from?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure all of that was because they were worried that the Chinese, you know, would come into the Vietnam War the way they did the Korean War. And so the politicians put us in a box, and that's where we stayed.
I know, because you were there in 67, and I was there in 69, fighting the same battles and the same hills and the same pretty much everything, probably. And it was extremely frustrating to those of us that were, you know, that followed you. And I, anyway, continue on. Lucia, who do you think would be most interested in reading your book?
You know, that's kind of a funny question in the sense of when I sat down to write the book, and again, Truth is Stranger Than Fiction, I asked the colonel, I said, you know, I was just exhausted. I didn't know how to start this thing called Vietnam. And he just assured me that just let the truth write itself. So when I began to write, I paid particular attention to a narrative that included but didn't inundate itself with military jargon or tactical information, because I wanted to grab an audience that was not just the military audience, but someone like me. I had never read a book about Vietnam before I had started this. I had no reason to. But anybody who had not understood the other side, you know, there are so many stories about, unfortunately, the Fourth Estate press that were untrue, that were barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to bring forth not only their own words, but in a way that someone could read it and find it interesting and find it not difficult as far as understanding the language of the Marines and the military, you know, military tactics, because it's difficult. I mean, there were documents and research papers that I didn't understand. There's a lot of acronym language, so to speak.
Right.
And I just really wanted the audience to be as vast as it possibly could, to cover every realm.
Well, I'm certainly would recommend this book to anybody, no matter what your age or generation, that this is an opportunity for you to learn about these men and some women and about the story in general of a just an incredible man. Our clock never lies. We've got to go here in just a moment. So I want to thank Colonel Eshaw and John Newton for being on Veterans Radio today. Thank you so very much for being on our program. And Lucia, go ahead.
I was just going to say you're very welcome, and I wanted to snatch a quick minute to say hello to my good friend, Major, now Colonel Eshaw.
Okay. Well, good morning.
Okay, John.
We'll let you
know. Yeah, you know, you want to... Yeah, if you got a second, my next-door neighbor, you know, was the air boss on the Enterprise in the Persian Gulf here not too long ago. And I gave him a copy of Dr. Tom's War, which he read while he was in the Persian Gulf. And he took the same position I did, that anybody who's faced with combat of any sort ought to read this book to better understand what they are about to be confronted with.
Right, I understand.
Okay.
Music is coming up. I want to thank all of you. Lucia, we'll promote
so much,
your book
sir.
Like crazy. Until next week,
okay.
You are
thank
dismissed.
You so much.
Next week, you are dismissed.
Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.